We danced so hard to the Chambers Brothers' psychedelic soul, I broke the heel off one black suede boot and threw the other one under the couch. Sally got blisters on her heels from dancing so long without stockings in fry boots. And when two police officers came to the front and the back doors to break up the party, Sally and I limped into the park, smoked Marlboro Reds until everyone had drifted out of the girls' house and doubled back so that we could drive home in my parents' Dodge Dart. It had some dead animal stuck in the carburetor. My father was a city boy and believed that cars, like subways, ran reliably without intervention. We drove all winter with the windows down and our hands over our noses. Good morning. I'm Nancy Williams, and I'm going to finish reading this humorous essay called Cooking and Stealing, written by Amy Bloom and published in a book by the same name as her essay, Cooking and Stealing. It's the Tin House Nonfiction Reader. And it ends, of course, with some yummy recipes, which I will want to share with you. But we'll get back to Amy's account of this lovely little time of her life when we may all have been there after high school and coming into college, late teens, early 20s. So she continues, "We were best friends from the moment we met. I thought her batik halter tops were sexy, as she hoped, and that her wide hips and short white hands were beautiful, and that her motorcycle riding boyfriend was glamorous. So glamorous, she locked me in the girls' room when he rode up after school because she thought I couldn't be trusted. And I don't say that she was wrong back then. Until I found him out, as weak and vain and helplessly cruel as Vronsky. She couldn't leave him, she said. She did, of course, before the year was over. She was dating a boy who was all not glamour, tortoiseshell frames and big ears, and no transportation at all. But he was sweet and yielding, incapable of standing her up or holding a lighter so close it singed the tiny blonde hairs on her smooth hands. But my job was to help her stay away from Mr. Motorcycle until she could. My job, as the better armored person, was to keep us out from under the people who made her feel bad, such as her peculiar parents, her smug and blank siblings, her conniving psychiatrists. Sally's job was to socialize me, to bring me in from the jungle. And when she got me tottering along socially, she taught me how to be a friend, through the usual approach of endless intimate conversation and the happy development of our mutual interests, stealing and cooking. Sally was a great shoplifter and a great cook, and when we weren't stealing stuff to wear, we stole stuff to cook. Sometimes, when she was intent on making something, we even bought the ingredients. When we became mothers and wives later, she became an even better cook and an upright person. And when she told me how she made her little boy bring back the chocolate bar he'd taken from the store, she didn't even wink. She stole a beautiful black bathing suit for me from under the noses of the discerning sales ladies at Saks Fifth Avenue, and she stole a James Beard cookbook because she admired him. In the midst of chaos, her psychiatrist father was as crazy in his way as her artistic mother was in hers. Sally cooked to create order and pleasure. We cooked as privately, as discreetly as possible, as if we were not engaging in the most shocking perversities. The wish not to be seen cooking by our mothers was enormous and pressing. Sally didn't want her mother, the love child of Edgar Allan Poe and Martha Stewart, if they had left the foundling to be raised by Iggy Pop, interfering and suggesting and turning our pleasure into some ghastly exercise in bonding that might end in our helping her make her astounding Hieronymus Bosch hooked rugs. Sally didn't want her father complimenting us on our newfound femininity. Her parents scared the crap out of me, and since my relationship with them consisted of my screeching around the corner at midnight as Sally leaped into my car in her nightgown and her mother hurled crockery at her and then at us, I tried to get in and out of her house invisibly. This once required me to hide under Sally's bed for an hour and a half while her mother talked to her about birth control. I didn't want my mother to see me doing anything ever, and since cooking in our house was largely a matter of defrosting the Stouffer's, the whole enterprise would have excited a lot of unwanted attention. But we cooked when no one was home. In particular, we fried. And when all that hot oil was too much and the spring leaves had started to unfurl, we made light and creamy things. I have not included among the recipes here her amazing chicken salad, nor our 6 different versions of Pim's cup, which we drank in our backyards while putting iodine and baby oil on our legs for a quicker tan. Sally was already sick, even when we were dancing to the Chambers Brothers, even when we wore our bathing suits to Jones Beach and let boys buy us French fries. By the time she was in college and out and then back in, and waitressing and clerking in bookstores, she had a brain tumor. Not trouble concentrating, as her mother said. Not a hysterical symptom, as her father said, but a benign brain tumor that she would have removed many times and that grew back each time even more resilient, even more tenacious than Sally was. She married a good man and had surgery. She had her beautiful baby boy and had surgery. She became a master teacher and had a couple of brain surgeries along the way. She cooked anyway. She cooked even when she became a high-wire act, and even when her sense of smell deserted her. I carried mint leaves and coffee beans into the ICU because their scent reached her. Everything reached her, and she never stopped grabbing it, sniffing it, running her tongue over it, even in memory. As she was dying, nurses and doctors crowded into her room just to be with her funny, kind, insistent self. She made me mind my manners with nurses who were not what I thought they should be, and she made me be generous with her time, as she was. She made jokes with her keyboard when she couldn't speak. She critiqued my work and dictated the most loving letters to her friends and family, key by key. Before her final surgery, we took our children out to Sardi's, which we had hoped would be nostalgic and glorious, and which was neither. Unhappy waiters served us terrible food. Sally, who hated to waste money and hated to make a scene, gathered everybody up, and, the effects of her last 3 strokes notwithstanding, flung her coat on as best she could, shook her head in reproach at the maitre d', and led us out. We came out on the street in front of 2 food carts, and after Hebrew National hot dogs for lunch, we walked uptown slowly for hot fudge sundaes. "Never eat bad food," she said. "It's not just bad. It's wrong." Every few days we got together at someone's house, someone whose parents were both at work, and people who liked to get stoned, and the 2 guys who liked to take acid took acid, and Sally and I, who got sleepy when we smoked pot and were terrified of acid, made apple or peach or tropical fritters. It probably takes 45 minutes to make these, and we sometimes did it in half that time when people were desperate, and sometimes in twice that time, depending on how many people were helping and what condition they were in. Back in that day, Sally and I sometimes chased these with shots of rum. Later, when the acid heads had become a beekeeper and a stockbroker, respectively, and all of the potheads had become what you'd expect, ophthalmologists, journalists, judges, mothers, and fathers, Sally and I still cooked these for ourselves, for neighborhood brunches, and for our little kids who loved them, if you managed to remind them, in time, not to burn the roofs of their mouths on the hot fruit. Here is a recipe for tropical fritters, which I will also put on the UPR Zesty Garden web page if you would like to not have to run after it with a pencil while I talk. Tropical fritters, which makes about 22 of them. Take 1 1/3 cups of flour, 1 1/2 teaspoons double-acting baking powder, 3 tablespoons of sugar, 1 teaspoon of ground ginger, a dash of salt, 3/4 of a cup of canned chopped pineapple, which you have drained, 2 smooshed up bananas, 1/2 cup of milk, a large egg beaten slightly, vegetable oil for deep frying, and confectioner's sugar for dusting. So in a small bowl, you just mix together the flour, baking powder, sugar, ginger, and the salt. You can sift it if you're so inclined. It doesn't need it. In another bowl, mix up the pineapple, bananas, milk, and egg, and then add the dry stuff and stir the batter until it's combined. In a pot, heat 1 1/2 inches of vegetable oil until it shimmers or reaches 375 degrees, 375 if you've got a deep fat thermometer. Drop the batter by tablespoons into the oil in batches of 6 and fry the fritters, turning them once for 1 minute to 1 1/2 minutes, or until they're golden. Pick up the fritters with a slotted spoon, place on paper towels to drain, and sift the confectioner's sugar over them. I say bon appetit. That sounds like a lovely thing to do on a rainy October morning, and I'm sure we'll have more of them. So until next time, this is Nancy Williams. Don't forget to check that recipe on the Zesty Garden website at upr.org.